At the beginning of this year, my wife Barbara took a grand tour of India with her two daughters. After the girls had returned home together, Barbara stayed on, and I joined her in New Delhi for a final 2 weeks. When I got there, we checked into a hotel, and in the late afternoon, we went for a walk without any particular destination in mind. In the distance, above the trees and rooftops, we could see a strange-looking structure poking out, kind of a white stubby cone. From the city map, we concluded that this must be something called the Lotus Temple, but we had no idea whether it was Buddhist, Hindu, Sikh, Jain, or Muslim, old or new, a ruin or a thriving monument. After crossing a congested highway and a sparse urban park, we came in sight of our goal. Soon, a fence surrounding the temple grounds stopped us, so we followed that in search of the entrance. We couldn't see a soul inside the temple enclosure, so we figured that the place must be closed. Eventually, we reached a street that seemed to lead toward the temple. We knew that we were on the right path because by now we were no longer alone. An unbroken stream of people was slowly making its way in the same direction. Nobody was in a hurry, but we could feel that happy buzz of anticipation that animates a crowd approaching a big public event. Everybody seemed to be happy. Tour buses disgorged more visitors, vendors hawked trinkets and drinks, guides offered their services. Most of the people were Indian couples and families with children, but there was also a sprinkling of foreigners. Clearly, we had stumbled on a major tourist attraction, and as luck would have it, it was obviously still open. When we came to the gate of the garden around the temple, we had to form a single file and pass through one of the metal detectors that have become routine in big cities everywhere. To our amazement, though, there was no sign of a ticket booth. So we followed the crowd, walking briskly along carefully tended lawns, shrubs, and flower beds. Soon, the Lotus Temple rose up before us, in its awesome size and breathtaking beauty. I think you can see it on that side, but not on this. To me, it looked as though someone had decided to fold up the Sydney Opera House so it could fit into a box for shipment. But the size of the structure, its exquisite symmetry, and its resemblance to a real lotus blossom soon drove such frivolous thoughts from my mind. Any moment I expected it to open majestically to reveal the jewel within. Could I have the next slide, please? It was a stirring sight, but we still had no idea whether we were approaching a sanctuary belonging to the Buddhist, Hindu, Jain, Sikh, or Muslim tradition. Before we reached the temple, we came to a small brick building where a well-dressed young man asked us politely in British English whether we wanted to visit the information center before proceeding. Nervous about time running out, we declined, so he smiled and asked, "How much do you know about the Baha'i faith?" We could hardly have been more surprised if he had been walking on water. "Actually, quite a lot," I stammered. "My daughter-in-law and my grandson happened to be Baha'i, but we were not expecting this here. We certainly need to learn more before we go on." So we followed his suggestion and entered the little museum in order to get some background on the Baha'i faith and on the Lotus Temple itself. The Baha'i, spelled B-A-H-A', is sometimes described as the newest of the world's major faith traditions. In fact, it is only a few years younger than the Mormon Church, The origins of the Baha'i lie in the 19th century in Iran, then known as Persia, where it grew out of a minor mystical form of Shia Islam. These roots did not save the Baha'i from being brutally persecuted by the Iranian Revolution a century later. From Persia, the sect spread rapidly around the globe. Today, there are between 5 and 8 million Baha'is in total, compared to perhaps 500,000 UUs. So among religions, Baha'i is our big sister and probably as unfamiliar to the general public as we are. A great number of Baha'i communities is scattered throughout the world, but there are only 7 large so-called houses of worship, basically one for each continent. The North American one, which opened in Wilmette, Illinois in 1953, is the world's largest. But as an architectural monument, it doesn't come close to the Lotus Temple in Grandeur. The Lotus Temple itself was finished in 1986 to serve the Indian subcontinent. And to my eye, it is by far the most beautiful of the 7. The number of people who visit it is claimed to exceed the numbers for the Taj Mahal nearby and even the Eiffel Tower. Upon recovering from the shock of finding something so unexpected and so magnificent, we rejoined the procession of tourists approaching the lotus. Up close, we discovered that it has 9 sides. We could see there's 9, some of those, 9 being a sacred number, and it is surrounded by 9 shallow pools. The park from which we've approached the temple happens to be on the side opposite to the entrance, which explains how we missed seeing the crowd that was assembling on the other side. The crowd inside the temple itself is strictly controlled. Although there are hundreds of seats, only a few dozen visitors are allowed in at the same time. In this way, we were spared the stifling crush that is familiar from other famous tourist sites, such as the Sistine Chapel and the nearby Taj Mahal. So we took off our shoes and quietly sat down inside. The first thing that struck me was the austerity of the place. Not a statue, not a painting, no religious symbol or icon, neither candles nor chandeliers, nothing but a few vases of flowers decorate the spare purity of the enormous vault. In that dirty, noisy, tumultuous city of New Delhi, the Lotus Temple offers a refuge, a precious oasis of serenity. Refuge for whom? In their unadorned simplicity, Baha'i houses of worship stand out from most of the other churches and temples in the world. The Lotus Temple turns out to be much more than just a sacred place for Baha'i worship, with an occasional opportunity for outsiders to visit. Open to the public all day, practically every day of the year, it was designed explicitly to appeal to all believers of all religions, so it avoids all religious symbolism. This open-armed attitude struck me as an astonishingly powerful gesture on the part of the Baha'i. Building the Lotus Temple was a gratuitous act of awe-inspiring spiritual generosity, or of generous spirituality. The welcoming attitude of the Baha'i houses of worship reflects a central pillar of the Baha'i faith. Called the oneness of religion, this principle asserts that all religions are fundamentally the same. Whereas we UUs promise to respect other religions and even to draw wisdom from their diverse traditions, the Baha'i go much further than that. They claim that since all religions have a common divine source, they all share fundamental and essential features, even though they obviously differ in specific details. Furthermore, there is certainly disagreement even within the Baha'i community itself about what exactly constitutes a religion and what cults and sects should have to be included. But the central idea is bold and grand. If all religions are indeed unified, then religious strife, which has done so much damage to humankind, will be eliminated and universal peace will reign. This is a noble goal, unrealistic perhaps, but worthy of respect and emulation. The Baha'i are not out to conquer the world and convert everybody to their religion. Instead, they stand at the open door of their house and invite the world to join them as sisters and brothers. A second related pillar of Baha'i philosophy is the oneness of mankind. It is counted among the most vital of the fundamental principles and holds that all people, regardless of race, ethnicity, gender, religion, or social standing, are equal in the eyes of God. The defense of civil rights for oppressed minorities is a proud chapter of Baha'i history in the United States and around the world. For us UUs, the same belief stands at the beginning of our covenant in which we affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Together, belief in the oneness of religion and the oneness of mankind account for the astonishingly colorful diversity of the men and women and children sitting in silent meditation all around me and waiting in the garden outside. All are welcome, all belong. A third Baha'i belief will sound familiar too, and is especially close to my own theology. It is the unity of science and religion. It reflects a profound respect for the role of reason in human affairs, but insists that although rational thinking can probe the mysteries of the universe in ever more detail, there will never be an end to science, that we will never know what Stephen Hawking called the mind of God is one of my own fundamental beliefs. After we had been sitting in the sanctuary of the Lotus Temple in quiet meditation for a long while, and the sun began to approach the horizon, my thoughts returned to our own sanctuary, right here at home. And from there, to the tiny little jewel of a chapel we are building next door. Right now. It's an ugly little duckling compared to the monumental Lotus Temple. But it will unfold its wings, and its purpose is the same. It would be our place of refuge from the turmoil of everyday life, a place that will inspire us to find meaning in the chaos that swirls around us and threatens to swallow us up. This morning began with a story to illustrate the idea that in meditation and prayer, pronunciation or even the precise words do not matter very much. Sitting in the Lotus Temple, I realized that the place where we meditate can be powerfully inspiring, which is why many meditators prepare their spaces with great care. But the surroundings, any more than the pronunciation, do not matter very much either. Meditation is not a matter of language, nor is it a matter of space. Even our tiny chapel is cavernous compared to the place where religious thought and feeling really reside, in our own hearts and minds. Within the magnificent cocoons of our physical bodies, we build our own theology, we tend to our own spirituality. Call it your spirit, call it your conscience, call it your inner self, call it what you will. Our souls, and not the temples or the churches or even the chapels we build, are the real jewels in the lotus. So may it be.